Good morning. My guest this morning is Bernard Saundry, the outgoing CEO of Racing Victoria. This interview was recorded on Wednesday of this week. On Thursday night, it was announced that the chairman of Racing Victoria Limited, David Moody, had resigned. I have Bernard Saundry with me, who's the outgoing CEO of Racing Victoria. Good morning to you, Bernard.
Good morning, Brian, and good morning, listeners.
Now, you announced 6 months ago that you were going to leave Racing Victoria. You've only been in the CEO spot for 4 years. It was announced halfway through this year. It came as a shock to a lot of people. Why are you going?
Well, BM, after 14 years at Racing Victoria in the last, as you say, the four and a bit years as CEO, I thought the time was right. We've finished off the year with a solid financial result. I thought the business is in good position, and I'm a great believer in reinventing yourself and making sure management teams continue to reinvent themselves, and I'm not immune from that, and I'm looking forward now to the next stage of my life.
It looks, from anyone looking from the outside in, it looks a pretty tough gig.
Oh, well, it's an enjoyable gig, Brian, and as you're well aware, racing's made up of a whole lot of different characters, and that's the great thing that I've enjoyed for a long period of time in racing across a range of different jobs. I love meeting people. I love making sure that a business, leading teams of people and getting outcomes is what I've been all about, and I think I'll leave the Racing Victoria business in pretty good shape.
Do you know where you're going?
No, I've got a couple of options. I'm going to have some time off with my family because, as you're well aware, getting family time when you work in racing is often difficult, and I'm looking forward to spending a bit of time with the family. Then I've got some options in the new year that I'm going to pursue, and it's just making that right decision about which direction I need to head in. I've got an option to stay in the industry, but those decisions will be made throughout February 2017.
Some suggestion within the ranks that the Racing Australia CEO job could have been yours, or you could have been the man to fill the breach. Is that on or off? Well, it's not on because Barry O'Farrell's been appointed former Premier of New South Wales. So were you in the running there? How close did you get?
Yeah, no, Brian, I certainly put my hand up for that role, but the Racing Australia board made a decision to appoint Barry O'Farrell. It's a good appointment, and Racing Australia's got a very bright future with the board and Barry, and I wish them all the best.
Okay, to our listeners on the SEN who may not, and I think most aren't diehard punters or racing fans, but they hear this program, perhaps, I hope they do, on this Saturday morning. Tell us, what is the structure of Racing Victoria? Because our listeners would know there's the VRC, the Victoria Racing Club, which is Flemington. There's the MRC, which is the Melbourne Racing Club, which is Caulfield, Sandown and Mornington. And there's the Moonee Valley Club, which is the Moonee Valley Race Club, of course. That's three individual clubs all doing their own thing, controlling their own, virtually their own boundaries, their own jurisdictions. So where does Racing Victoria sit? It's the governance of the industry.
That's correct, Brian. It's the controlling body for the sport in the state. As you've said, the three metropolitan clubs are each member shareholders in their own right. We've got Country Racing Victoria that represents more than 60 race clubs in regional and country Victoria. And then we have 10 other member shareholders of owners, trainers, jockeys, unions, jumps associations, bookies associations, all that amount to 14 member shareholders we have in our business, all with different needs and wants. And one of the great challenges and enjoyable challenges is to try and manage the expectations of all those different stakeholder groups. And it's something that, you know, Racing Victoria has worked on for a long period of time, whether it's clubs seeking more money, clubs looking for different dates, or stakeholders looking for more prize money. It's Racing Victoria's obligation to balance the needs of all the stakeholders and all the clubs to ensure we continue to grow and develop the great thing about Victorian thoroughbred racing.
The history of Racing Victoria as a structure would be around 20 years old, would that be right?
Yeah, it's it evolved out of the VRC in 2001 to a body really as a business in racing. Racing Victoria is a relatively new business. It's 16 years old. You know, the clubs have hundreds of years of history, and it continues to evolve. It provides now a funding stream to the clubs of north of $300 million a year, and looking forward to, you know, to growing and developing that revenue line.
There are many partnerships that you're involved with, and one, of course, for racing in this state is with Tabcorp.
Tabcorp's a massive contributor to the economic benefit right across the industry, whether it's providing stake money, club funding, but it is our biggest revenue line. It's the most important joint venture that we have. And the beauty about the JV, it provides a diversification of revenue, not just earning revenue off racing, betting on Victorian racing. The JV also earns revenue from betting on all the products that the joint venture offers to customers, not only in Victoria but across Australia. So it's an important revenue stream for the three codes in this state. We have a license that expires in 2024, and Tabcorp will and continue to play an important part in the funding of Victorian racing.
So how does that fit in the mould? How does that fit with corporate bookmakers?
Well, in essence, we want to see the best of both worlds. And the JV has been an important revenue source for the three codes since 1993. As we're all well aware, corporate bookmakers are now here to stay. They're licensed in other parts of Australia. We now have legislation that allows Racing Victoria to charge other wagering operators licensed in Australia a product fee. And we do that, and that revenue stream has grown from zero in 2004-05 to $140 million today. So as you can see, wagering operators that are licensed outside of Victoria have to pay a fee to bet on Victorian racing, and we've got to make sure that fee is competitive to ensure that customers outside of Victoria continue to engage with Thoroughbred racing across the 550 race meetings we operate every year.
So for those corporate bookmakers operating on Victorian racing, what do you give them in return?
They pay for the right to bet on Victorian racing. They also, there's the top six operators that pay for the vision of Victorian racing, and then they go off and sell Victorian racing to their customer base.
An incredible growth with that, isn't there? But what flows back into the industry is so important.
Well, that's right. We've got clubs to fund, infrastructure to fund, customer development programs we need to fund, and importantly, the other one is prize money. And there's over $180 million in prize money that flows back to the participants. And we all know how important prize money is to trainers, jockeys, owners, stable hands, track riders. It's the economic driver by which the industry survives.
In talking of prize money, there's been an increase with prize money in metropolitan Sydney, and there's a history, and there's a long history of prize money sort of fights, or not so much fights, but battles between New South Wales racing and Victorian racing. The prize money for a Saturday race outside carnival time in Sydney, metropolitan prize money, is now $100,000. We're not quite there. We're still shy by about $10,000 to $20,000. Now, the argument put up by trainers straight away when that increase happened in New South Wales was, what are we going to do? We've got to compete. And I heard some trainers say, and I was a bit surprised to say that, it could drive owners out of this state to race the horses in New South Wales. I don't follow that line of thinking, because it's all about going to see your horse run. So how do you balance? What's the counterbalance from Victoria?
Well, I think, as I said, Brian, prize money is an important indicator, an important economic contributor to, our participants, and we completely understand that. There will be prize money increases in Victoria. How we apply them to ensure we continue to grow ownership, to continue we offset the costs that owners incur to racehorses in Victoria, will be developed over the next 3 months. But I'll reiterate, there will be prize money increases. How that applies will be determined in late February, early March. But I think the important aspect from the important point you made, in Victoria, we're very lucky here where you can within 2 hours of Melbourne, you can access nearly 450 race meetings. In the biggest states of Queensland and New South Wales, it's not easy for a trainer to access multiple number of meetings like 450 race meetings on a daily basis. So we're very lucky that we've got a model, we've got a geographical spread of clubs that they're easy to get to, and we've just got to make sure the next allocation of prize money, whether that's metro and country, is done to ensure our field sizes. We're very proud of our field sizes that continue to drive wagering outcomes in this state, continue to grow in order to feed the industry that operates in the state.
What's the approximate field size now? Is it running at around 11?
10, just about 10.4. So whatever we do to prize money, we're going to make sure we hold that and grow that number.
It's interesting you talk about, you know, geographically positioning of race tracks in Victoria. We're a smaller state, as we know, of New South Wales and particularly Queensland. But you would be aware that we have more race tracks in Victoria than the whole of England.
Yeah, it's quite astounding. In fact, right across the eastern seaboard, when you talk about England versus the rest of Australia versus Victoria, there's 65 tracks in Victoria. There's 100 tracks in Queensland. I think there's 80 or 90 in New South Wales. And collectively up the eastern seaboard, we conduct probably 2,200 race meetings a year. So it is quite extraordinary, all funded differently. A lot of them, you know, operated by volunteer labour. But it's a massive economic benefit to each of those states. And I don't think we should ever underestimate the impact that Victorian racing has on Australian racing, and particularly on Victorian racing in this state.
I own horses. I have horses in syndicates, and I'll do that till the day I die. I love it, and I love seeing people get involved, and we have so much fun. But they come at a cost, you know. They slow ones, fast ones, champion ones, ordinary ones, all eat the same amount and all cost the same. So if you budget on, say, $45,000 to $50,000 a year, have your horse trained by your trainer, winning a race worth $20,000 at Bairnsdale or $15,000 further out isn't going to take much of it, put much of a dent into the bottom line.
Well, you need to win two of those races, don't you?
Well, more than two.
Okay, so you need to win three races to cover those costs on an annual basis. And what we're seeing, we've got just over 55,000 owners in Victoria, and what we're seeing more and more of is the, like what you're doing, Brian, is creating syndicates and people coming together, enjoying the ownership experience, meeting the trainer, going to track work, having a great day out at the races, and that's all part of what we call the owner's experience in Victoria. We're now emailing and sending videos of races and the opportunity to purchase photographs immediately after the race, and we see that as an important component, as is making racing cost effective. So a key component of the next increase in prize money will be to ensure that we can continue to offset the costs that owners incur.
It sounds, just by the way you're speaking and you're talking about the next couple of months at an increase, it sounds as though we get a better deal here in Victoria, perhaps, to the other states in terms of the spread right across, you know, to those meetings on a Monday or even the non-tabs, even floating right down to picnic racing.
Absolutely, BM. And I think the other important thing is it's a different funding model, Victoria versus New South Wales. And I don't want this to be a Victoria-New South Wales thing. I mean, every state does a fantastic job. We need a vibrant national thoroughbred racing industry, so that's really important. But I think we do invest money in other areas, and New South Wales has got the right to do that also. I think they've done a terrific job with the championships, and Queensland Racing are now getting back on their feet. So, yeah, vibrant Australian racing is important. Victorian racing, we've got the benefit of having racetracks close to each other. I mean, people talk about, can we justify the number of tracks that we've got in Victoria? Yes, we can, because the majority of tracks are run by volunteer labour. You can't build an economic model with those tracks that race once or twice a year to close them. In the future, you'll see further regionalisation of racing and training. You'll develop centres of excellence for training and racing, and those outlying tracks will play an important role for the community, and it's something that thoroughbred racing needs to continue to build on.
Yep. Bernard Saundry, my guest this morning. This is your Racing Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Bernard Saundry, my guest this morning on This Is Your Racing Life as we count down to Christmas. Bernard, the big issues in racing, there are plenty of them and we can't ignore them, but surely in the world we live in now, integrity is nearly a top spot.
Well, I think that's important, Brian. I mean, the two things that give us a social license to exist is integrity and animal welfare. And you know, we've over the years invested heavily in integrity. At the end of the day, it drives the economic model that exists in this state. We've got $5.7 billion a year that's turned over on Victorian racing. And integrity is at the cornerstone of ensuring that punters have confidence and the participants operate on a level playing field.
Yeah. In your time sitting in the chair for the last 4 years, there have been major issues that won't go away. The Danny Nicolick situation, here we had a gifted jockey, one of the best in the land, that just continued to really sort of walk headlong into problems with the chief steward here. Where did you sit on that?
Well, I mean, I think it's important that what every licence holder has to understand, that there's one rule book and it has to be applied fairly. We've got over 180 jockeys in this state 900 trainers and 55,000 owners and, you know, literally millions of punters that rely on an integrity system that is equitable and fair. And our stewards do a terrific job in that space. You know, from time to time, do we like some of the situations that end up in the media? No, none of us like that, but it's the job that the stewards are employed to do to ensure there's a level playing field for all participants.
There's got to be a policeman. There's got to be a city hall with something like this in any sport, and particularly with the amount of money that's involved. The cobalt situation, it's dragging in towards year number three. We never, ever thought it'd go this long, but we're talking about penalties that will, we don't know what the outcome's going to be, that can finish the career of horse trainers and prominent high-profile horse trainers. I know it's probably difficult to talk about the Kavanagh and O'Brien situation at the moment, because at the moment the judge through VCAT, who heard it all, is going to hand down his decision. It wouldn't be too far away, I wouldn't think. So it'd be sub judice to talk about it, but what damage do you see it doing the industry and the perception? Because perception, in more often than not cases, is reality in the eyes of many.
Well, I think that's the price that's paid for having one set of rules, and we know that this matter's before VCAT. You're correct in saying that those the announcement by VCAT will be in the course of the next few months, I hope, and that, you know, the trainers and the trainers can then determine, the future can be determined. You know, at the end of the day, we've got one rule book, as I said. Ideally, you wouldn't like any of these things on our plate at the moment, but it is what it is.
Peter Moody left racing, was thrown out of racing through a positive return with Cobalt for a shorter time, but he decided to walk away from the sport. He's a fringe player at the moment. Look, to the public's eye and to a lot, racing still needs a guy like Peter Moody. Peter Moody is a great character, but more importantly, he's a fantastic horse trainer. And folklore will show in the passage of time that he was the trainer of the Great Black Caviar. Do you see Peter Moody coming back? And again, you probably didn't want that outcome.
Well, BM, Peter Moody has done fantastic things for the sport. There's no doubt about that. He realises there was an indiscretion. He's done his 6 months. He's quite free now to apply for his licence. It's probably fair to say the last time, a couple of times I've seen Peter at the racetrack, he's enjoying his life, either working with Rosemont Stud, inspecting yearlings, providing advice, and it's something that only Peter Moody will decide whether he comes back and applies for a licence. And yes, he's a character, has been a
character. He didn't throw rocks at you at the races?
No, there were no rocks thrown at we have robust discussions, and that's who Peter Moody is. You'll never change that. And he's always got his firm views on different issues that apply in racing. And, I listen to lots of participants about how we've structured this business in the past, and Peter Moody's no different.
Yeah, it's interesting to see whether he does come back in a training role. I'd be surprised if he didn't, but he'd probably structure it a little bit differently in terms of numbers of horses and the involvement, because it's a incredibly big business that they operate, these guys.
You're right, BM. The level that these trainers operate, where they've got literally 100, 200, or 300 horses either in work or in adjustment or in pre-training, it's a 7-day-a-week, 14-hours-a-day commitment, whether it's on the phone, talking to owners, dealing with staff, getting horses prepared, going interstate to horse sales. It's a massive commitment, and I take my hat off to trainers in this state where it's important that they realise connection with owners, building out their businesses is important, but they do it at a cost sometimes to their own health and well-being, and they do it at a cost to their family at times. So you do need enormous family support to operate at that level, and it's a thankless task at times.
Yeah, and Racing Victoria is the body that issues the licence for these various participants and thousands of participants within the racing industry. The drug issue now within the people involved in horse racing. We saw a case with an ice positive return from a horse of Chris Waller's, and Waller, the buck has to stop with the horse trainer at the end of the day, and he got fined $30,000. But with stable staff and jockeys and right across the board, that's an extra, not so much burden, but it's an extra thing that has to be controlled.
Well, it's interesting. It's a really good point you raise, Brian, because I think over the years, as stables get bigger, not only of these trainers fantastic horsemen, but they have to be really good at running a business, dealing with staff issues, management, dealing with owners and communication and marketing. You know, the role of a trainer has changed dramatically, particularly with the advent of social media and the way communication platforms have opened up over the last 10 years. And it means trainers have to adapt accordingly. And it's placed greater pressure on trainers in terms of accessibility by the staff, by their owners. And we're living in very much a changing world.
You know, the old horse trainer would say, well, I train the horses, and the girl in the office, as he'd term it, would send out the accounts. And you'd talk to different trainers and they'd say, well, I couldn't even turn a computer on. That world has just done a 360 degree turn, hasn't it?
It certainly has. And if you just take those two examples, the administration for a trainer is now more complex because there's more owners in horses. I know if you go back 25 years, there were six people that could race a horse, and they used to be mates. They knew each other. They'd pay their bill to the trainer and never heard, you know, it was a great relationship. Now you've gone from six owners to 10 owners to 20 owners to potentially four syndicates of 20 owners. So the trainer, in terms of the complexity of running a business and the communication of all those groups, is a massive change in the way trainers need to operate today. And every owner, whether they own 1%, 5% or 10%, want to know what's happening on the horse, where's it running, and is it a chance to win its next race?
And a lot of owners actually, they don't show to have a trainer's licence, but they do assist. The old famous story with Bart Cummings, someone said to Bart years ago, Bart, how much a day are you to train? He said, $65, but 80 if you help.
Yeah, well, these Bart's had some great sayings over the years, and he's sorely missed. He's been a legend of the sport, and what he's contributed to thoroughbred racing at the age he was contributing it at, there's not too many people at that age contributing to sport and life generally, and the iconic status that Bart had, it's been fantastic that the achievements he's had, and rest his soul, he's done a wonderful job for the industry.
Yeah, there's no question of that. Let's have a look at the Spring Carnival and the economic impact that this Spring Carnival does have onto the economy of Victoria, but particularly to the industry here in Victoria. And look, there seems to be no ceiling. It's probably a silly thing to say, but there seems to be no ceiling. And I've had the good fortune to travel the world and see racing at so many different jurisdictions. And we see the figures that are returned and the crowd figures and turnover figures. It's something that really, it's the jewel in the crown and something that we're so proud of here.
We're very fortunate, Brian, that over a long period of time, successive administrations, club executives and committees have invested heavily in this time of the year, and it is fantastic to see. We turn over in the 6 weeks $2.28 billion in wagering turnover. That's up more than 4% on last year. And what we've got to remember now, that the Victorian Spring Carnival is not only a jewel in the crown for Victorian racing, but it's also a jewel in the crown for Australian racing. And importantly, with the benefit of technology, we're now being able to shoot pictures all around the world. So the Spring Carnival was seen in more than 50 countries across the world. It is truly a global sport. It's world recognised, and the Spring Carnival benefits from that with the fantastic influx of international visitors that come and watch 1, 2, 3, or 4 weeks of racing. I think one of the spectacular bits of data you see come out of the economic benefit for Victoria is when every hotel room's booked out for 3 or 4 weeks around spring. So we've had to bring four massive cruise ships into Melbourne with more than 6,000 people who have come to enjoy what Melbourne's got to offer, enjoy the spring racing carnival, and then sail back to New Zealand or Fiji or up to Brisbane or around to Perth. So it's getting to the point where we've got to bring boats in to accommodate people to sleep overnight.
It's extraordinary, and you can see actually from Flemington on the day, particularly Melbourne Cup Day, you can see some of those vessels at the back of the track where they're docked, and they are just massive. They're some of the biggest cruise ships in the world, and they're coming in, as you say, for 3 to 4 days or whatever it is. You just wonder, is there a ceiling with our Spring Carnival?
Well, I think there's a ceiling certainly to how many people we can accommodate on the racetrack. So I think, you know, that the days of the 100,000 crowds at Flemington, where I see as comfortable, is probably about the limit in terms of making sure the customer experience is right. Moonee Valley's about right at 30 to 35. Caulfield's about right at 35 to 38. So every track has its own uniqueness. Every track has its capacity. And I'm sure if you talk to every CEO of every track and committee, they want to make sure that the customers that go to these events walk away and say, I want to come back next year.
Yeah.
And Country Racing does a fantastic job, whether it's Cranbourne Cup, that Mornington, Ballarat Bendigo, the standalone meetings we have across regional Victoria. There are limits, but what's important, I think, is that the media play an important role in making sure that if you can't get to the track, at least you can have a flutter, you can engage on our social media platforms and be part of the spring in so many different ways.
How have the two standalones within the last month, Ballarat and Pakenham, how have they stood up in terms of turnover on a Saturday?
Well, the Ballarat meeting was very good, both in terms of turnover and attendances. And Pakenham, a couple of Saturdays ago, you know, Michael Hodge had 3,500 people booked in, pre-booked for that meeting, and the crowd ended up being, with walk-ups, about 8,000. The turnover, we did just on $28 million in turnover, and that is comparable to what that meeting would have generated at Sandown the year prior. So I think the pleasing aspect is what it demonstrates, that we've got Pakenham, Mornington, Bendigo and Ballarat as four standalone meetings. They've been introduced over the last 3 years, and we see green shoots in terms of attendances, and we see green shoots in terms of wagering turnover. And I think the important thing there is that the cost of racing, opening up grandstands and making money that can be done at those four venues, when it comes to, I call them second tier race meetings in metropolitan areas, it's an expensive operation for a metro club to open up their stand for 4,000 or 5,000 people. So we're going to be cognizant of that as an industry. We're going to make sure we, in the peak wagering day of a Saturday, that we continue to grow and develop wagering. As long as wagering continues to improve above what we'd normally expect on a Saturday at a metropolitan venue, and if those fields can generate good turnover, those standalone Saturdays will continue to grow and develop, and the club makes very good money out of it.
Yeah, and they're a great thing for the town too. Well, you know, Ballarat's a city now. It's a wonderful city and a growing city. And Pakenham and that's around there. That's, you know, the growth rate out in that corridor is incredible now.
Ballarat have done a magnificent job with the stables they've built. They had 13,000 people at their standalone meeting. Pakenham have now, they've got 600 acres down there, a 2,400 metre grass track, a 2,000 metre synthetic track. They've got a boutique grandstand, and then for their cup day a couple of weeks ago, they built out a range of mobile facilities, and everyone thoroughly enjoyed it. And it's people in the east being able to go and enjoy Pakenham Cup on a Saturday, people having Christmas parties as lead in to Christmas, and the racing was first class.
Bernard Saundry, outgoing CEO of Racing Victoria, my special guest on This Is Your Racing Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Bernard, racing and racing on television, racing's own channel, what did we learn from the demise of TVN?
Well, I think it was a shame to lose TVN. It was back in the Christmas of 2014 where we, for nearly 10 years, had a model where we showcased Victorian and New South Wales thoroughbred racing, and we lost that due to some disagreements between the two states. I respect the views of other states and the role that New South Wales wanted to pursue, which was at odds with Victoria. And what have we learnt? So we've learnt that through the first 6 months of 2015, we had robust discussions with Tabcorp and Sky around what and how Victorian racing could be seen and distributed through various media platforms. In order for us to get complete flexibility around how we wanted Victorian racing distributed, we wanted a flexible unbundled arrangement, and that led us to presentations from Channel 7 and also Sky. At the end of the day, we landed on the Channel 7 outcome, which has now seen a joint venture between Seven West Media and Racing Victoria with a free-to-air Channel 78 digital platform available to 95% of the Australian population. That also allowed us to distribute the pictures, our digital pictures, to wagering operators, also on racing.com and to Tabcorp themselves. So it allowed us to unbundle, allow us to also allow Sky to continue to distribute our pictures internationally. That's worth circa $9 million a year. That's selling Victorian racing to international markets, particularly into Asia and then into New Zealand, which New Zealand is our key market. And we've learned a lot in that, but Sky are an important partner in distributing our pictures offshore. So we wanted to unbundle the situation, unbundle our media rights, make sure that our free-to-air television was a way to grow the sport, grow interest in the sport. And in the first year of our operation, we've seen turnover grow 6.4%. And we thought we'd grow at 6%, so it's a little bit ahead of where our expectations were. And, you know, turnover is not the only measure of success on free-to-air television. It's making sure we get more people engaged, to make sure we expose and advertise and market and promote the great product that we have at our racetracks right across Victoria. It's about getting more people to own horses, more people to come on track, and more people to breed horses. So we want that engagement not only to happen in terms of a wagering experience, we want people to explore and experience Victorian thoroughbred racing at every level.
The night racing exercise, which has gone from Moonee Valley now to Cranbourne, now to Pakenham, you've been a part of the latter two. How is it working? It makes it sort of probably tough on a lot of the participants within the industry if they're working through the day and then working that night. But I suppose that happens right across the workplace of a lot of people in life now. But what are you reading? What's coming back to you from, say, the last 12 months, 2 years?
Yeah, well, it's Brian, that we see the night racing is an important component of the overall entertainment of what Victorian racing offers. The turnover at night has been very positive for us. When you look at racing on a Monday afternoon, in total we're probably generating $5.5 to $6 million in wagering turnover and having 300 or 400 people attend the racetrack. On a Friday night, those numbers can hit, if it's a Cranbourne or Pakenham, 9 to 10 million, rising to 15 to 16 million if they're racing at Moonee Valley, and we're getting more people to come and watch the sport in their leisure time. So it kind of ticks two boxes. One box of ticks is we can get more people to the racetrack, and the second box of ticks is we can generate more wagering turnover.
Animal welfare, you spoke, we mentioned that perhaps the two biggest issues or the two things that you focus on more than anything else would be integrity and animal welfare. There's an off-track program that's in place for retired racehorses. We have Living Legends for those who have got to the top in their chosen field, the thoroughbreds, and I was a part of that for setting that up back in 2005, and it's very close to my heart. Yeah. But looking after the animal is so critical.
At the centre of what we do is the horse. Without the horse, we don't have an industry. And over the last 12 months, we've had extensive dialogue with a range of industry participants and built out a more formalised equine welfare strategy. And we've got programs and initiatives that will happen before racing, during racing and after racing. We will develop our own equine welfare advisory panel made up of stakeholders and different veterinary groups. We want to make sure that we know the traceability of every horse from the time the horse is born through to the time it leaves racing. And, you know, there's nothing more important from an owner's perspective and the stable hands and the track riders. Everyone in the industry loves their horses. They live with them. They spend 12 and 14 hours a day with them. So I don't subscribe to the activists out there that say, oh, we don't care for our racehorses. We do care for our racehorses. We've got 60 vets that look after the racehorses at race meetings, and then we want to be able to track horses when they do leave racing at the end of their racing career. And we sponsor more than 400 events in the last 18 months, whether it's polo, whether it's other equestrian structures. But we do care. We do the thoroughbred is the number one priority, and we do have 35 initiatives that will be rolled out over the next 18 months, 2 years in those segments of before, during, and after. And as I said, the thoroughbred's at the centre of everything we do.
Yeah, that's good to hear, because it's the thoroughbred that brings people to the racing, and it clearly defines the punter and the racing fam. We saw it with Black Caviar and Spades, and it was just something fantastic. It'll happen again. It's happening with Winx right now. A lot of people have said that you missed a marketing opportunity with Michelle Payne after the Melbourne Cup.
Yeah, well, we did. We had a discussion with Michelle immediately after the Melbourne Cup. We put to her to become an ambassador, but Michelle wanted to focus on her own riding, and particularly then advancing into training. And she also had advanced a management group to look after her affairs. But I've got to say, Michelle Payne's done a wonderful job in being our own ambassador, in whether it's a movie, whether it's appearing in other sporting circles, in social circles, and balancing that with training and racing. I think she's done an amazing job. Mm. And, you know, Michelle's been very supportive in being involved in the launch of our Spring Carnival. There were a couple of other things Michelle have done for us. So, you know, when I look back and say, would we have loved to have Michelle as an ambassador? I'd say, I think Michelle has been an ambassador and will continue to be an ambassador for the sport in this state. I don't think we've lost anything. In fact, the way Michelle has put herself out there and spoken and represents thoroughbred racing has been a credit to herself, credit to her family, and she's got a very bright future, a busy future ahead, trying to manage riding and training and dealing with owners, and then being a personality and being in demand for riding a Melbourne Cup winner. So she's got a pretty full book of things to do.
She's extraordinary. She has a training licence as well as being a jockey. First one to have one in Victoria. And we've got this nonsensical situation where she can't ride in New South Wales because she's a trainer here in Victoria. Can that be rectified?
Well, we've certainly... you know, first, I have to respect New South Wales have got every right to implement whatever they want to do. We took the view that we were satisfied with whatever integrity risk that may bring. We've satisfied ourselves in the conditions of both the trainer and jockey licences. And, you know, we'd like to think at some point that position would change, but I respect New South Wales' position they take to make the decision they have.
With marketing of racing, and it seems to happen particularly around carnival time, we get these ads on television in prime time of models out on the lawn, you know, sipping champagne and holding up winning betting tickets. How long do we have to keep putting up with that rubbish?
Thanks, Brian.
It was your plan. That's one you failed dismally.
Well, have we failed dismally? I mean, everyone's got an opinion. I respect that. And I respect your opinion, Liam. I think at the end of the day, we've been able to demonstrate that the results of that campaign, we went into the market early this year. Yeah. We took advantage of the break in the footy when we launched our carnival on the 1st of September. That was a football-free weekend. We try to push as hard as we can to capture the hearts and minds of people to say, hey, spring's in the air. We want you to book your ticket to go to the races, and we want you to focus on thoroughbred racing from now through to the middle of November. So we took the decision we took. I know you didn't like it, but the results do speak for themselves. We're pleased, but you know, every year we challenge ourselves to say, what can we do different? And I'm sure we've got an autumn campaign coming up in the next, you know, by January, and then we'll roll into spring again, and it'll be different again, because in marketing and in anything creative, as you know, many years in building marketing programs, it needs to be different, it needs to be talked about. And I'm a great believer in, as long as the media are talking about you, you're remaining relevant.
Yeah, well, you can take that different ways. What about the model that you had with the body paint? That didn't last too long. That was a failure.
Oh, well, yeah, okay. There were some aspects that I respect that we had to withdraw, and we did. So you win on that front, mate.
Thanks very much. The ownership experience, the 30-minute gap between races, that's been tried. It's tried at night racing and during the week on the Wednesday meetings, etc. Is that working? What can we see on the Saturdays?
So I think what we did, BM, we took a bold move and said, let's go 30 minutes year-round. And that created some issues, particularly with the coordination of the clock on Saturdays and Sundays when we've got more racing than we have Monday to Friday. And we looked at during the trial, we looked at the turnover impact, and it did start to impact us on a Saturday. So we went back to what we see as the traditional mix of gaps between races. That's 35 to 40 minutes. But we were determined to keep that top and bottom of the clock operational from Monday to Friday. And the feedback we get from participants is very positive. So from trainers and jockeys and owners' perspective, if we can shorten up the race meeting by 30 minutes, that's been a positive for them. They can get home and see their families a bit earlier. So that's here to stay, Monday to Friday. We have to be a little bit more flexible on Saturdays and Sundays. We have to remember we're already at 30 minutes at night time. So I think it's the right thing to do. I think it hasn't, as the trial has bedded down, turnover continues to improve Monday to Friday, and we are now benefiting by going back to the 35, 40-minute breaks of a Saturday.
Okay, let me ask you this. As you're right off into the sunset and you're doing a wish list for Santa, what would you like to see in racing in the future here in Victoria?
That's a really good question, Brian. What would I like to see? Well, we've got a very solid future fund that we've developed over the last 3 or 4 years. We need to make sure that we've got media platforms that allow Victorian racing to be seen anywhere, anytime, on any platform. I think it's important that racing has some control over its customer database. I think it's important that you'll see the facilities, metropolitan facilities, the investment in those. We're seeing the VRC have launched the announcement of their new grandstand that's currently under construction and will be finished in August 2018. I think the issue around how much needs to be invested at Caulfield and at Moonee Valley is an ongoing debate. I want to see customer facilities built in the metropolitan area that is the envy of any sport or any other racing jurisdiction in the world. And Victorian racing deserves that. I want to see that we continue to grow prize money, which the board has the capacity to do, and that'll be known in the first quarter of next year. And I think I just want to make sure that, you know, we remain relevant in a very busy sporting landscape.
What's going to happen to Sandown?
Sandown, well, we've got the Melbourne Racing Club have built out a master plan, and they're looking to do some development at Sandown. We're supportive of the principle of what Sandown and Caulfield want to do. The Melbourne Racing Club, in the first 6 months of next year, will finalise their tenure arrangements at Caulfield, and then the balance of their master plan then can be communicated to their members. But that's a job that they're working on intently internally, and it's something that Racing Victoria supports.
What's the future for horse trainers at Flemington and at Caulfield being housed on course?
I think that question, I think, is a longer term question. The question, I think, for the industry will be, can we sustain the mix, getting horses and to mix at racing and training facilities where they're intermingled or commingled? One of the great things that I keep hearing is that trainers say we need more access to grass, and that can often be conflicted through whether their EBAs in place with staff, whether it's, you know, trainers having to get off racetracks by 8:30 in the morning. So I think you'll see over time the need for specialised facilities for training. You know, I'd love to see, like Ballarat's got, like Pakenham will have, an uphill grass track that might be 1,600 metres long and 100 metres wide, where horses and participants can go and engage and train their horses from 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning without having to wake up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I think as society, as we evolve as an industry, that's one thing that will change.
Or weather track for the northeast, surely.
Yeah, that's something that we'll look at in the first 6 months of next year. It's fair to say that we've had a really wet winter. We've had Seymour out of action. That's come back online on the 19th of November. The participants love the expansive track up there. We'll conduct 22 race meetings. We're doing some work, just finished work at Wangaratta. We're doing some second stage works at Wodonga. So once we get all those tracks back operational, where there'll be more meetings placed in that area, and if we've still got a lack of track infrastructure and the weather doesn't stay kind to us, that'll be the time to make a decision around a synthetic track.
Good luck to you, Bern. You've been a good friend of the media. We've had different opinions from time to time, but the door's always been open for us to come and talk to you about different issues. And I wish you and Sam and the family a happy Christmas, more importantly, a safe new year. And to wherever you go, from a lot of people, the best of luck.
Thanks, Brian. I just want to say thank you to you. And our friendship goes back a long way. And I've been very fortunate to be involved in an industry that has been very good to me. I've been privileged to be the CEO of Racing Victoria over the last 4.5 years, and I'll look forward to seeing you and the listeners on a racetrack somewhere.
Good on you. Bernard Saundry, my special guest. Great to chat with him on This Is Your Racing Life.